Hi, I'm James McIlvenny, and you're listening to the History and Philosophy of the Language Sciences podcast, online at hifilangsci.net. There you can find links and references to all the literature we discuss. In the previous two episodes, we surveyed the emergence of comparative historical linguistics and its entanglements with language classification. And now we've arrived in the middle of the 19th century. By this time, comparative historical linguistics had become a firmly established field. The methods pioneered by such figures as Bopp and Grimm had been applied by scholars to work out the details of other parts of the Indo-European family. We can illustrate this by listing a few examples. Friedrich Christian Dietz published from 1836 to 1844 his Comparative Grammar of the Romance Languages in three volumes. Franz von Miklosich, from 1852 to 1874, offered a comparative grammar of the Slavic languages in four volumes. And in a relatively modest two volumes, Johann Caspar Zeuss set out a comparative grammar of the Celtic languages in 1853. The methods of comparative historical linguistics were also being applied outside the confines of the Indo-European language family. To name just a few examples, Wilhelm Blake produced in two volumes, from 1862 to 1869, a comparative grammar of the Bantu family. This is a language family that extends over great swathes of sub-Saharan Africa. The Dravidian family, spoken predominantly in the southern part of the Indian subcontinent, was sketched by Robert Caldwell in 1856. The links between Chinese and Tibetan were recognized by Richard Lepsius in 1861, and this laid the foundations for the Sino-Tibetan family. And finally, Hans Kornun von der Gabelentz outlined relations between several Melanesian languages of the South Pacific in two publications in 1861 and 1873. Attempts were also made to join language families into larger units. One notable example here is Bopp's attempt in 1840 to link the Indo-European family to the Malayo-Polynesian languages. The Malayo-Polynesian languages are today considered one of the major groups within the larger Austronesian family, and most present-day linguists don't believe that there's a credible genealogical link between Austronesian and Indo-European. In fact, it would seem that Bopp was only able to put forward the link between Indo-European and Austronesian by abandoning his own method. His comparison is based largely on superficial lexical similarities, which are the result of borrowing of words from Sanskrit into Malay, rather than on deep underlying parallels that could be reconstructed in grammatical forms. Another sign of the maturity of comparative historical linguistics in this period was the way in which its principles and methods were received outside its immediate disciplinary confines. As Anna Morpurgo Davies comments in her 1998 History of Linguistics in the 19th Century, if scholars working in such traditional areas as philology, language teaching, lexicography, and so on, wanted to be taken seriously, then it became necessary for them to be aware of the advances made in comparative historical grammar and to apply its results in their own work. If we now return to the standard narrative of comparative historical linguistics, the next great figure who we meet in the middle of the 19th century is August Schleicher, who built his reputation by refining the methodological apparatus of the field and pushing its limits. Of particular interest for us in this podcast is the fact that Schleicher also explicitly articulated a philosophy of science underlying his linguistic project. So far, we've seen how linguistics, as it developed into an institutionalized discipline, became increasingly narrow and technical in focus. We may recall from episode 2 August Wilhelm Schlegel's wry remark that Bopp's monomaniacal obsession with the minutiae of grammatical forms amounted to pedantry. Those who consciously thought about the methodological basis of the emerging field embraced this narrowness. Many started talking about a distinction between traditional philology, which was concerned with the study of languages for the purposes of understanding the literature, history, and culture of those who speak them, and linguistics as a study of languages for their own sake. Jakob Grimm, for one, made this distinction in his Deutsche Grammatik. Schleicher continued this line of thought and sharpened the contrast between philology and linguistics. He believed not only that linguistics was a science interested in language for its own sake, but that in addition to this, it should not be concerned with the peculiarities of individual languages, but rather that it should seek the immutable natural laws, as he put it, that govern all human languages. For this reason, Schleicher believed that linguistics is different from the other historical sciences that trace the development over time of individual things and should be counted among the natural sciences like physics and chemistry, which search for universal laws. Schleicher, we see, has in effect inverted the outlook of the discipline, while scholars from the earlier Romantic generations in linguistics emphasized the individuality and uniqueness of the languages they were studying, Schleicher wants to find the universal principles common to all languages. The effect of Schleicher's position on his technical work is that he became more consequential in the application of sound laws. Earlier scholars, including Bopp and Grimm and Schleicher's contemporary Georg Curtius, were all rather resigned about the inevitable remainder of forms that couldn't be accounted for with sound laws. It seemed that there were always a few words and grammatical forms that just didn't fit into the sound laws. Schleicher wouldn't accept this, and he pushed harder to refine his sound laws to eliminate this annoying remainder. A further consequence of Schleicher's approach is that he imbued the results of the comparative method with a new degree of reality. For his predecessors, the reconstructed forms of the various proto-languages remained more or less on the level of hypothesis. But Schleicher took a position that would today be considered a kind of scientific realism. He didn't consider the objects that he worked with as theoretical posits, but as entities in the real world. Schleicher had enough faith in the reality of his reconstructions to go ahead and write a fable in Proto-Indo-European in 1868. His fable is called, in translation, The Sheep and the Horses. Schleicher's fable has become a favorite plaything of Indo-Europeanists up to the present day. Here's a recording of Indo-Europeanist Andrew Bird from the University of Kansas reading a version of the fable updated to include the latest ideas about how the putative Indo-European proto-language probably sounded.
Haue ich us me, hoch nach ne hest, so hech wom stärkt, so grhum wokum wegged, so mechum bottom, so digmonum hoc you bedded. Ho is hech woipios weoged. Digamonum specio, hecumsque hageti, cermoi agnutor. Hecos tu veugund. Cludi, o ve, tot speciomes, uns me agnutor cer. Digamo, potis, se hauis hoch nach quermum vestrum wept, hauibios tu hoch nach nehesti. Tocicnuos, hois hagrom buged.
In the paper in which Schleicher presented the fable, he said that a translation is of course superfluous for all who are to some degree at home in Indo-European, but nevertheless he offered a German version of the tale for his more ignorant readers. An English translation of Schleicher's German version would be something like the following. A sheep, on which there was no wool, that is, a shorn sheep, saw horses, one driving a heavy wagon, one carrying a great weight, one carrying a person quickly. The sheep said to the horses, "The heart is narrowed in me, that is, I'm very sorry, seeing people driving the horses." The horses said, "Listen, sheep, the heart is narrowed in those who have seen, that is, we are very sorry, since we know, people, the lords, make the wool of the sheep into warm clothes for themselves, and there's no wool to the sheep. That is, but the sheep have no wool anymore. They are shorn. They are even worse off than the horses." Having heard this, the sheep turned into the field. That is, it ran off. This story of interspecies exploitation has a certain artificial quality to it, and it's of course limited by what words and idioms Schleicher felt he could reconstruct with sufficient confidence. But it's also interesting to observe the image that Schleicher seeks to project of his Indo-European forebears as masters of the beasts of the field, who they use for their own personal gain. We should note that this exaggerated commitment to realism was perhaps even a little bit embarrassing for Schleicher's contemporaries. This is apparent, for example, in the preface to the third edition of Schleicher's Compendium of the Comparative Grammar of the Indo-European Languages, which was his magnum opus. This third edition was prepared after Schleicher's death by his former students August Leskin and Johannes Schmidt. In a footnote, Leskin and Schmidt inserted the disclaimer that in putting forward his very definite reconstructions, Schleicher didn't necessarily assert that the words once really existed in precisely this form. We may, however, legitimately ask to what extent this disclaimer reflects Schleicher's actual views, and to what extent it's an attempt on the part of his disciples to posthumously rescue his reputation. A further product of Schleicher's elevated realism was his use of the family tree diagram to represent the relations between languages. As we've discussed in previous episodes, the notion that languages could be related to one another in a genealogical sense was the founding insight of comparative historical linguistics, and was long recognized before Schleicher. But it was Schleicher who was the first to popularize the visual representation of these relationships as an actual family tree, as we might draw to show the pedigree of real-life animals or a human family. The analogy with biological organisms was very much intended by Schleicher. As we've already seen, even in the earliest days of comparative historical linguistics, for example in the work of Friedrich Schlegel, biology was held up as a model science for the nascent field. Schleicher continued and deepened these connections with gusto. In fact, Schleicher not only drew an analogy between biology and the study of language, but claimed that languages are in reality natural organisms, and therefore part of the natural world. In 1863, he published a remarkable pamphlet called The Darwinian Theory and Linguistics, in which he said, "Languages are organisms of nature. They arose, grew, and developed according to definite laws. They become old and die out." Schleicher's pamphlet was inspired by reading a German translation of Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species, the first English edition of which appeared in 1859. Darwin's theory was taking the English-speaking intellectual world by storm and was being eagerly promoted in Germany. Schleicher's goal in his pamphlet is to affirm the validity of Darwinian evolution and demonstrate its applicability to the alleged natural organisms that are human languages. Subsequent scholars have generally taken Schleicher's claims at face value and talk about his Darwinian linguistics. But if we read Schleicher's pamphlet closely, we see that he had a very idiosyncratic understanding of Darwinism. It would seem that Schleicher was in fact projecting his own pre-existing ideas onto Darwin. Many of Schleicher's contemporaries in Germany recognized the move that he was making. They didn't describe his work as an example of Darwinism, but of materialism. In mid-19th century Germany, materialism was a highly charged word, rarely used by scholars to describe their own work, but usually as a term of abuse for others. Schleicher rejected the term for himself and preferred to call his philosophy monism rather than materialism. We'll come to what exactly this means in a minute. But despite these terminological battles, we can identify a specific historical movement of scientific materialism, which had its base in biology and with which Schleicher was aligned. At the dawn of the 19th century, biological theory was dominated by romantically inclined approaches that are often grouped under the title of Naturphilosophy, or philosophy of nature. To our eyes, Naturphilosophy may seem to be bound up with a large dose of mysticism. In order to account for the functioning of living organisms, proponents of Naturphilosophy would usually appeal to such invisible powers as vital forces or the soul. But with the rapid improvement in scientific instruments in the first half of the 19th century, in particular microscope technology, it became possible for biologists to directly observe the individual cells that make up organisms and even the minute goings-on inside them. It was now possible to conceive of cells as little machines working on the same physical principles that can be observed on a larger scale. Appeals to vital forces or the soul now seemed incurably speculative and superfluous. Of course, questioning the existence of the soul and other supernatural powers challenges the business model of some rather powerful social institutions, such as the church. While some scientific materialists trod carefully in this area, the most strident members of the movement weaponized their science and wielded it against religion and the conservative politics with which it was allied in this period. The political dimension of scientific materialism was most pronounced around the year 1848. In this year, simmering social tensions came to the boil and resulted in uprisings across Europe. In Germany, a pre-parliament came together in Frankfurt am Main in an effort to unite the patchwork of more or less independent German-speaking states into a single political entity. An embarrassingly large proportion of the representatives in this parliament were professors who advocated liberal political positions. In this context, liberal politics means, in the first instance, a belief in limiting the power of aristocrats and instituting constitutional government. But it also entailed a strong element of nationalism. The goal was, after all, to unite the German nation, understood as being all those who speak German and excluding those who do not. We already encountered an expression of this kind of nationalism in episode 2, when we looked at the work of the Grimm brothers. In fact, the Grimm brothers were among the representatives who sat in the Frankfurt Parliament. The plans of the Frankfurt Parliament were incompatible with the interests and rivalries of the ruling houses across the German-speaking world. The Parliament's resolutions were ignored and the uprisings put down by military force. It would be another 20 years before German unification would come about, and not from below through democratic agreement, but from above through the overwhelming power of Prussia, and without the participation of Austria, which remained the centre of the multi-ethnic Habsburg Empire. As a young man, August Schleicher moved in radical liberal patriotic circles. During 1848 and its aftermath, he was a correspondent based in Austria for two German newspapers. His articles evince a clear sympathy for the liberal cause and were considered sufficiently incendiary for him to have had several run-ins with the Austrian authorities. Schleicher's scientific reading was also very much oriented towards the work of the scientific materialists. In his Darwinian Theory and Linguistics, Schleicher names three figures who inspired his understanding of evolutionary theory. These three figures allow us to triangulate Schleicher's position in the contemporary intellectual landscape. The first two names are Matthias Schleiden and Karl Vogt. Schleiden was a botanist whose work on cell theory had inspired many scientific materialists, although Schleiden himself shied away from the religious and political implications of his work and later disavowed the materialist movement completely. Vogt, a professor of zoology, was by contrast one of the ringleaders of political scientific materialism. He wrote a series of Physiologische Briefe, or physiological letters, that were serialized in the Augsburger Allgemeine Zeitung, one of the newspapers to which Schleicher contributed as a correspondent. Vogt's letters convey the latest discoveries in the life sciences to a general audience, and over time became increasingly polemical in tone in attacking traditional views about mind and soul. Vogt was also a representative in the Frankfurt Parliament of 1848. His political activities eventually resulted in his being exiled to Switzerland. The third name Schleicher mentions is that of Ernst Haeckel, to whom he in fact dedicated his Darwinian essay. As Schleicher himself explains in the introduction, it was Haeckel who recommended that Schleicher read Darwin's On the Origin of Species, and thereby prompted him to write the essay. Haeckel was a good friend of Schleicher's, and also his colleague at the University of Jena, where Haeckel was professor of comparative anatomy. Haeckel was one of the chief promoters of Darwinism in Germany, and was also active in liberal politics in the second half of the 19th century. Haeckel advocated a modern, scientific view of life and the world, against traditional religion and the conservative political interests with which it was aligned, and he was frequently cited by his opponents as a leading representative of materialism. In concert with Schleicher, Haeckel rejected the term materialism as a description for his philosophy, and preferred to call it monism. Both Schleicher and Haeckel, and other like-minded thinkers in this period, insisted that they didn't seek to reduce everything to matter, but rather simply that there is only one kind of substance that is neither matter, mind, or soul, but all of these at once. This is why it's called monism. There is supposed to be only one kind of thing. So Schleicher's claim that languages are literal natural organisms is the outcome of his materialist or monist philosophy of science. But it would seem that his liberal political views reinforced these philosophical and scientific ideas. In the following years, Schleicher doubled down on his materialism. In his 1865 essay, On the Significance of Language for the Natural History of Humankind, which is essentially the sequel to his 1863 Darwinian essay, Schleicher explicitly collapsed language onto a single material plane. He said, "Language is the symptom perceptible through the ear of the activity of a complex of material relations in the formation of the brain and the language organs, with their nerves, bones, muscles, and so on." This statement from Schleicher is reminiscent of a scandalous observation that Forkt made in his Physiologische Briefe. There, Forkt said, "All those abilities that we conceive of as activities of the soul are merely functions of the brain substance. Or, to put it somewhat crudely, thoughts have the same relationship to the brain as bile to the liver or urine to the kidneys." The place where Schleicher's materialism finds its most pronounced expression is in his theory of morphology. This is a term that Schleicher brought into linguistics from biology, and which has since become a generic term to describe all of the linguistic processes that occur at the level of the word. In the next episode, we turn to Schleicher's morphology and contrast it to other efforts at typology in the mid-19th century, in particular the work of Steinthal.